Hello and welcome to episode 67 of A Little Bird Told Me, the freelance writing podcast that tells you all the tricks of the trade. You can find us on the web at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com, and from there you can find links to subscribe, whether you are a fan of iTunes, RSS feeds, or Stitcher, and that way you can make sure that you're the first to hear when we have a new episode come out. On that page, you can also find a link to our Facebook page. You definitely want to like us on there. We share all sorts of interesting and relevant news and blog posts and just helpful pointers for freelance writers. I am Philippa Willits, and today I am bringing you a very exciting interview with an amazing woman called Lucy Hay, who is the expert in all things screenwriting. So listen in to find out everything you've ever wanted to know about writing for films, why some films work and some don't, how films are funded, how much to disclose on social media, that's always an important issue, whatever kind of writer you are, how to use Twitter hashtags, and everything else from cyberbullying to teenage pregnancy and giving women more opportunities to be heard. So, without further ado, here is the interview. Enjoy. So, I am here with Lucy Hay, who is a script editor, script reader, and author, and she runs the amazing website Bang to Write. She is also one of the organisers of the London Screenwriters Festival. And she has a wealth of experience in all areas of screenwriting. She's written two non-fiction books and writes young adult fiction. And as if all of that wasn't enough, she also runs writing workshops in schools, addressing social issues as well as writing skills. So, Lucy, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really aware that screenwriting is something that we haven't covered at all on the podcast, and so I'm really glad to have the opportunity to chat to you, really.
Well, thanks very much.
So, could you tell us a bit about your own career, kind of how you got into the area you're in?
Absolutely. Well, basically, I always wanted to be a writer. And when I was much younger, I wanted to be a novelist. And then I, basically, a long story short, was I became a teenage mother. And I became absolutely convinced that, you know, all of those dreams were all over for me. And I was going to do the normal kind of things that you're supposed to do. And basically, a friend of my mother's gave me £20.
Right.
And I was really not well off at all at the time. But she said to me, I had to spend that £20 not on the baby, not on foods, not on nappies. I had to spend it on myself.
Right.
And I went into a bookshop and there were two books in there. And one was called Teach Yourself Novel Writing and the other was called Teach Yourself Screenwriting.
Okay.
And I bought both of them and I read them both. My baby was extremely grisly and all he did was cry, literally. All he did was cry for about the first 6 months of his life. So I remember reading these two books, baby crying 24/7. I lived in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a field. You know, I didn't see anyone, didn't have any friends. You know, I only ever saw my parents. So I read these books really, really quickly and I was like, oh, I want to be a screenwriter. And I went on... I looked in the UCAS handbook because, of course, it wasn't even really the internet in those days.
Yeah.
And I saw that Bournemouth University had a screenwriting for film and television BA. And I thought, oh, I'll go for that. And so I did, and I got on the course, and I just got really into screenwriting in general and thought, oh, I still can't really make a career of this because, of course, you can't make a lot of money a lot of the time. And I thought, you know, did I want to be a literary agent or something like that? But I didn't really want to move to London. And anyway, I ended up on a work placement with a literary agent and he took me to BAFTA. And
oh, wow.
I know. It wasn't the actual BAFTA awards, but it was, you know, the BAFTA place and there was this big thing going on and people were coming up to me and saying, you know, what do you do? And I didn't want to say, oh, I'm a student and a single mother.
Yeah.
I said, oh, I read screenplays, because, I mean, it wasn't untrue. I was reading these screenplays for the literary agent. And they said, oh, will you read my screenplay?
Ah.
I'll pay you. And I was like, oh, okay. So I kind of fell into it very randomly, really. And from there, I started doing other work placements with various initiatives and screen agencies and things like that. And then I got paid jobs at screen agencies and for production companies and things. And I was reading these scripts from home. By this point, I'd graduated and I was working in a supermarket at one stage.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted to set up my own business. So I kind of built that into the ethos of the company, was I was doing my production company work or working for literary agents and then reading for private clients on the side, because in those days, I mean, there's a lot of script reading companies around now, but I mean, I suppose this was what, 2004, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, before Twitter, before Facebook, before the blogs, all the screenwriting blogs were really getting going. And, I realized that, you know, most script reading companies were extremely expensive. You're looking at about £100 for a report, you know, by the, you know, 10 years ago standard, that's even more than it is now.
Sure.
And I thought, well, I could actually do a no frills kind of script reading service, and as a result got a very loyal fan base of clients to begin with, and then it got bigger and bigger, and I launched the blog as well, and things just kind of spiraled from there, really, in a very organic way. And I was very fortunate that people wanted to kind of get on board with me, and I think it's because I didn't bullshit them. I said, this is what's wrong with your screenplay, or this is how you can improve it, but it is up to you. You know, it's about you and about what you want to do with your work. I'm not going to give you some kind of magic formula and you're going to be so successful. It's all about, you know, personal growth as a writer as well.
Yeah.
And I think people appreciated that, and they liked my honesty, and they liked the fact that, you know, I wasn't going to bullshit them, but equally I wasn't going to be nasty to them either, because in those days, the script reading services were very, this is crap, whatever.
Right.
And as a result, you know, would be very demotivating. And I'm not about demotivating. I want, the very fact that anyone gets their creative work down is quite miraculous, really.
And then to send it off to somebody else.
Exactly. I mean, it takes a lot of guts.
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of putting all your dreams on paper and you're kind of offering it up to someone to kind of, you know, potentially rip to pieces. You know, I think that's brave. And I think that always needs to be remembered, I think. So I'm always
definitely
to kind of support my writers. And I think, you know, the vast majority of my writers like that. And that's why they come back to me so much.
So what's the role of a script reader? Is it to kind of just give a general assessment of kind of a third party view of a script? Or tell me more about what it is you actually do when you receive a script, say.
Okay, well, I mean, it depends what a writer wants me to actually do. I mean, if they want me to just literally read their screenplay, then they'll probably hire me to do like an overview report, which is basically an assessment of how their script works on the page.
Yeah.
And so I'll look at its story, I'll look at its characters, its dialogue, its arena, which is like the story world. It's not just the location, but also how all the bits within it work, you know, maybe using literary allusion or motifs and things like that. And then there'll be a miscellaneous section where I may look at things like script format, because scripts have to be laid out a very specific way.
Yes.
Or spelling, punctuation, typos turn up quite regularly under the miscellaneous section. Titles, a lot of the time writers choose titles that are just completely inappropriate or just really boring or vanilla or whatever.
Yeah.
So just, you know, all the random things that, you know, that are part of the package.
Yeah.
So that's an assessment basically as a script reader. My most popular service is probably the development notes, though, and that's more of a script editing function. And that's less to do with assessment and more to do with development in terms of actually making it better, looking at the issues and saying, well, have you considered this way of looking at this character? Or have you considered this way of changing the structure so it reflects the theme better? And just really delving in much more detail into the screenplay. So, yeah, that's script reading is about assessment. Script editing is about kind of facilitating the story, making sure that it is the best that it can be.
Yeah. And it's interesting because although I don't do anything like that, I do a fair amount of non-fiction editing in various forms.
Sure.
That can be kind of on a very just like proofreading for commas level, or it can be on a, do you think this is well structured? Do you think this needs more? And it's something I find interesting relates to what you were saying earlier about how you, about you being very honest and not sugarcoating things, but also not being unnecessarily cruel.
Yes.
and it's, that can be interesting from an editing point of view in general because, yeah, some people feel almost fragile and some people feel very...
Yeah, I mean, some clients will be more needy than others, and that's always the case. And I hesitate to make generalisations, but very often female writers will need a lot more kind of coaxing than male writers. I do find that an awful lot. And I think it's... I think it's something to do with the fact that women are told, you know, from being very little girls that if they do certain things, they're maybe showing off, perhaps.
That is a real, yes.
So I think that sometimes I do spend a lot of time kind of counselling female writers to say, you know, you are good, you can do this, you know, you can get out there and do that, you know, and I have to kind of, you know, I'm a bit like a kind of like a life coach for some of them, you know.
Yeah.
And it does, a lot of male writers, you know, can be like that as well. But I just find it really striking that women writers do it so much more. Also, there's not as many women writers. I mean, when we at London Screenwriters Festival, we probably have about 50-50 now because we're quite, we work very hard to kind of be as inclusive of female writers as possible.
Yeah.
But I've been very struck by in the past going to events that it's been like, you know, 80% male, 20% female at best. Mm. So at part of London, I'm part of Bank Writers, you know, we've got to make sure that the female writers feel confident and able to share their work and not vulnerable, if you like.
I also find there are people who send me their work saying, I really want this to be as good as it can be. Just do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who are a lot harder to deal with who kind of send it for validation that it's great.
Yeah.
And they don't want actual criticism or feedback, really. They want you to say, there's nothing I can do with this. It's perfect already.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely the case. I mean, in the olden days, when I first started, I would say most writers were probably like that.
Mm.
I'd say since the internet has come about and since there's so many writing forums and so many writing websites all saying you've got to be able to take feedback, you've got to be able to deal with it.
Yeah.
Writers have got a lot better in recent years.
Yeah.
They know that they can't just write something and send it out and it'll just get made by Steven Spielberg. They're a lot more, they're a lot more realistic these days. I mean, when I used to send notes back, you know, they'd be great notes, you know, and I'd work really hard on them. They'd be like, what the hell is this, you know? So they can take it a lot better than they used to for the majority. Occasionally, I'll come across someone who goes absolutely nuts when I send notes back to them, and in which case, you know, I just kind of let them run themselves out and, you know, sorry you feel that way, you know, all that kind of stuff. And most of the time, you don't know why they've reacted so badly. It could be because they feel, they feel let down because they believe that this was the draft that would work, or maybe they've made lots of sacrifices that you don't know about in terms of family time to get it done, you know, and they feel just very disappointed, you know, not so much in your notes, but in the way that it's not worked out the way that they wanted to, and in which case you've just got to let them get on with it. And if they really, really don't like your notes or whatever, sometimes you'll send some notes through and it won't be what they expect. I had a guy a couple of weeks ago who hired me for an overview report, and I think he thought he was going to get development notes. And he kept asking me loads and loads of questions. And it's like, well, why didn't you hire me to do the development notes? Because it's all laid out on the website, you know, what you get for your money. But, you know, a lot of new writers, they just don't kind of process these things. And in which case, you just got to kind of chalk it up to experience and just, you know, let it go and move on.
Sure. So from your point of view, what would be the ideal point at which a writer would send you a script? Is there a good point in the process?
It's hard to answer that one, to be honest, because different writers work in different ways. I mean, my main collaborator is J.K. Amalu, and he made Deviation in 2012, and we're making Assassin at the moment.
Yeah.
And he will basically send me a logline, and a logline's like a one or two sentence pitch of the story, and we'll throw the logline back and forth and, you know, start fleshing out some characters, turn it into a one-pager, turn it into a short treatment, turn it into a longer treatment. A treatment's like a plan, if you like, of the whole screenplay. Then he'll go to draft when we're happy with that, and we'll start going through the draft. So we, you know, I'm literally with him every step of the way through the drafting process. I mean, one project of his I was reading today, it's now on like the 18th draft.
Right.
Yesterday I read a screenplay of his that's on the 23rd draft. You know, he really drafts things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's a professional writer. He's been doing this a long time. With new writers, I would, you know, most of them haven't got the money to put 23 drafts through a script reader. And on that basis, I would say they need to do a lot more peer review before they probably show it to a paid-for reader.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, there's loads of ways to actually facilitate peer review now.
I was just, you just mentioned forums, and I see a lot of forums where people do that for each other. And
absolutely, yeah. And a lot of them, they get actors involved and do read-throughs. That's a great idea, you know, because actors are always happy to do that because they like to know the writers. And if you know more actors, then you can do like plays all together and read-throughs and stuff like that, you know. And it, the more people you know, and the more people who are involved in the industry, and the more favors you can do for each other, then the more of a place you have in the industry. Because I mean, when we say the industry, there isn't really any such thing. It's just a bunch of people who are working together, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's crazy that some writers will literally lock themselves away and not try and work with other people as much as possible. You have to make a team wherever possible, I think.
Yeah.
So because it's all about making the chain, and then you find more people and more people on top of that.
Yeah. Are you always hired by a writer, or are there occasions when, I don't know, a production company or someone might hire you to read through a script?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've read for screen agencies. A screen agency are like the lottery funding people, and they to give money out of like the lottery pot. And I read for Scottish Screen for years, right up until they became Creative Scotland in like, I think that was 2010 or 2011. I read at the moment for an investment company called Premier Picture that down in Brighton. They are a private investment company. Basically, they award money to various films for various things. You know, it might be for poster campaigns, and or it might be to finish the film, or various things. I'm never told what the money's for.
Sure.
I'm just literally given the screenplay, and I'm told to like, write a synopsis and my thoughts on whether it's got, you know, commercial viability as well as storytelling viability.
I read an article recently about this, just about investors investing in films which is a kind of slightly risky thing to do, but can be incredibly lucrative if it goes well from their point of view.
It absolutely can. I mean, there's lots of really great business models that producers can tax things that producers can take full advantage of to, make a lot of money for investors. And so it's something that people can make stacks of cash on. Absolutely.
Sure.
And it's not something that I really understand in massive detail, because I'm not about the business. I'm more about the storytelling aspect.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting thing, and it's something that I personally want to learn more about, because I think it's really, really interesting, because banks do it as well. Banks will actually have a film arm and they will actually offer money to filmmakers. I mean, this is how I understand it.
Yes.
They offer like a loan to the filmmaker. The filmmaker takes up the loan. The film then belongs to the bank, and then and then the producer has a certain amount of time, which they agree to pay the money back. And if they can't, then the film belongs to the bank like forever. So it's kind of like a mortgage, but it's sort of for a house. It's for a film.
And that's the strangest thing.
Yeah, and you know, all of the big banks apparently have these film arms for filmmakers. I think you have to be quite a big company to be able to access these things. I don't think it's something that, you know, any indie filmmaker can access, but certainly all the working titles and guys like that may do this kind of thing. And then of course there's just the private investors who are individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of these guys, these investors, they're rich as creases. They really are. And they know a good deal when they see one.
Yeah.
And they know what's going to work well. And they will just throw money at stuff massively. You know, sometimes they haven't even read the screenplay. They've just read the treatment. And they're like, yep, no problem. Or they've read the package, which is like, who's in it, who's directing it, those things. And who's the sales agent, that kind of thing. And they just... You know, some of these guys, they just know, they're such good businessmen, they just know whether they can get a return or not. And it's really, really interesting stuff.
In terms of banks, I'd far rather my bank invested in films than, like, the arms trade.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe I should publicise this more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember some bank guy coming in to talk to us at university, and I was like, you know, why don't we know about this?
So, had you always been interested in films even before you found out really about screenwriting?
Yeah, I always loved films. I remember for my 13th birthday, I was given a director's chair.
Fantastic.
As Alien, I thought it was the coolest thing ever, and I saw this documentary about Ridley Scott, the director of Alien, and I remember thinking, I'd love to be a film director. But I didn't know what went into it, you know, being a 13-year-old girl, and certainly, you know, knowing what goes into the role now, I don't think it would be for me after all. I mean, script editor is just the perfect job for me because, you know, I get to arse around with stories and, you know, write crazy notes to self. You know, I found one the other day while I was cleaning up. It said, "Whites, why not ferrets?" What the hell was that about? I've got no clue, but there you go.
Are you ever able to watch a film without analysing the script?
It's quite difficult to. I must be really good, then I won't analyse it. And certainly 2013 movies. One was Gravity. Mm-hmm. Absolutely became 100% involved in Gravity. I absolutely adored it. And also Frozen, which I really liked as well. And also Rush as well. The racing one.
Yeah.
And what I loved about all three of them was they were all so different. I mean, Rush was absolutely unapologetically masculine. It was like super, super masculine.
Yeah.
Like, it was like a Lynx advert, but to the power of a million, you know. It was great. I adored it, you know. And, of course, you get to see, you know, Thor's arse all the way through it, which for me was a big thrill. Frozen. I loved Frozen. It was, you know, about teenage kind of realizations and sexuality and, yeah, and coming of age and all that kind of stuff, all the things that are, you know, predominantly girly. And I loved that, yeah, because it was really nice to see a story that dealt with what it was like to be a girl, you, yeah, know. And because even films for little girls with female protagonists don't always deal with that kind of stuff.
No, absolutely.
So that was really nice. And Gravity, I just loved, because the threat to her life was so great and so massive. You just weren't sure if she was going to make it, yep, which hardly ever happens, because you're going, oh, yeah, well, she'll be all right. She'll be all right. But right up to the last minute, I was thinking, I don't know if she's going to make it. You know, yeah, the threat, the jeopardy was just fantastic. Yeah. And what I loved about it was it wouldn't have mattered whether she was male or whether she was female. Everything that she had to go through, she had to go through and she had to deal with, no matter, you know, it transcended gender. It transcended, yeah, everything. It was just about, do I want to live or am I going to die? Am I going to literally lay down and die or am I going to fight for my life? And I love that, yeah, because it's a great metaphor for what so many people go through on a smaller basis on their everyday lives. You know, if you've been through something like cancer or a terrible illness or something like that, and you're having to fight that battle within yourself, to actually see it kind of projected,
yeah,
at, in a massive 3D way, I just really appreciated it. It was like, it was a great metaphor for the human endurance, and I just loved it.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because we recently had a brief discussion about a film that I was watching at the time, which, mm-hmm, technically should have had some of those same, mm-hmm, dilemmas and issues, sure, which was called The Ledge.
Right.
And on paper, to me, it sounded like, oh, this should be interesting. It's essentially a man standing on a ledge, and he's been told that if he doesn't jump off the ledge at a certain time, somebody else will die. So, mm-hmm, he's got about an hour and a half to decide whether or not he's going to jump to save this other person's life, mm-hmm, or whether he's not, and this other person's going to die. And I thought, oh, that sounds quite, you know, I could get into that. But in reality, it wasn't engaging at all.
Yes, it was a real shame, that, yeah, movie. It was an indie film. I believe it might have been a Canadian film. I'm not sure. But it starred, what's his name?
The guy who was on Queer as Folk. In the,
yes, Charlie Hunnam.
That's the one.
Yes. The Ledge starred Charlie Hunnam, who of course is a big hunk at the moment from Sons of Anarchy and from Pacific Rim. And I actually really enjoyed Pacific Rim. I mean, it was your classic kind of the Americans are going to save the world and, you know, yes, all that kind of nonsense. But it reminded me very much so of Independence Day, you know, those, yeah, kind of, you know, great fun, yes, and but also, you know, with a human element to it that was, yes, actually very appealing. You know, there was lots about it that was quite unusual, yes, in the same way that Independence Day was, but way back in 1994. So it was a bit like being 15 years old again, and, yes, and watching those kind of movies in the 90s with Arnie and Will Smith and all those kind, yes, of guys. So I really enjoyed Pacific Rim, and it was really good, and he put in a good performance in that. And of course he's ace in Sons of Anarchy. And I liked him in Queer as Folk as well.
Yeah.
He's a good actor, Charlie Hunnam. So I got the movie out because, like you, I like the concept, yeah, and I like him as well.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is going to be good stuff. I'd also just recently seen another film that was very similar called Man on the Ledge.
Okay. No, I haven't.
Yeah. That one stars Sam Worthington as the guy on the ledge.
Okay.
And then we've got Jamie Bell, Billy Elliot.
Yeah.
And basically, in that, Sam Worthington's on a ledge. He's going to jump because basically it's all a big ruse, because he's actually drawing attention away from Jamie Bell, who's trying to rob a massive jewel.
Okay.
And it's a big jewel heist, and it's to do with revenge. And as you watch it through the movie, it gets bigger and bigger, and it gets more and more out of control. And it was very exciting. It was absolute nonsense, but it was very exciting. So I thought, oh, okay, the ledge should be quite good then. And as you say, it simply was not, because they basically took a great concept. Basically, we've got Charlie Hunnam on the ledge, and he's talking to the cop, the guy from The Brave One, who, again, put in an amazing performance in The Brave One. He was fantastic in that. I can't remember his name either. I can never remember anyone's name. But, yeah, the guy who plays the cop, who is in The Ledge, who was also the cop in The Brave One, he was fantastic in that film. I loved The Brave One. I thought that was great. But, unfortunately, in The Ledge, what let the entire premise down was two things. The first thing was the fact that he's on the ledge, and then we get out of that by him telling his story, and it all goes back in flashback. That immediately saps the jeopardy, because, you know, all the time you're going backwards. It lacks forward looking momentum.
Of course, It
totally undermines everything. You know, the whole deadline of an hour and a half, boom, it's all gone, you know, and it's just a nightmare. So that's a real shame, for starters. And that would have been bad enough. It wasn't for the fact that the premise doesn't stand up, because if he's got an hour and a half before the husband shoots the wife in the head, and he's telling his story to the cop
for an hour and a half,
what the problem is.
I know.
And it's like, what the hell was that all about? Who thought that was a good idea?
After I watched it, I read lots of discussion online about it, and people were coming up with reasons why he didn't. But it all, they really just wanted to not be so annoyed with it. Yeah. So we're forcing reasons out of nowhere, really, just in order to feel less like, oh, why? This is so obvious.
But, I mean, they might have got away with it if they had provided us with really great characters. But unfortunately, they didn't. We've got Charlie Hunnam's character, who's so bitter and twisted about the death of his wife and child. He's just always going on about God and life not being fair and you know, all these kind of other things. Then we've got the husband, who's such a homophobic wanker, you know, and he's so evil, and he's so much older than her girlfriend, who's such an unbelievable sap. I mean, bloody hell. Liv Tyler just spends her entire career playing these really sappy women. You know, it's like, for God's sake. And then we've got the gay roommate, who's such a stereotype as well, who's only there just to actually facilitate the husband's
homophobia.
It's just crazy. You know, everybody was a cardboard cutout.
I initially heard about the film it was when it came out, really, and it was the talk in the kind of skeptic atheist communities around it, because it was kind of being billed as this atheism versus belief thing. But actually, that was so over-egged.
It really was, you know. And it's a tragedy. I love the idea.
That could have been an interesting extra angle. But in reality, it was just like, oh, stop whipping that now.
I know, definitely. I mean, this is the problem with so many spec screenplays that I read, is that a writer will have like a personal soapbox of some kind, whether it's atheism or religion or feminism or, you know, anti-bullying or whatever. And they will just keep whipping it, like you say, just over and over. It's like, oh, you're hitting me in the head with a brick. Stop it.
That's it. You know, we can see, you know, we don't need everything pointing out.
I mean, this is the thing with theme, is theme of any creative work is essentially read into by the audience member and their response anyway. So you can put whatever you like into something, they're going to see it their own way anyway. I mean, I was having a conversation with one of my banter writers the other day. We were talking about Frozen, and she thought that the song Let It Go was about being gay. And she had, you know, some really great reasons for why it was about being gay. And certainly when she said that, I thought, oh, yeah, it could be, actually. But then I'm not gay. So I wasn't thinking that at all. I saw it as actually letting go of the past, letting go of, you know, mental health issues, changing your response, you know, all these things that I personally had been through, I then put onto the movie. And then she had put on, you know, this notion of being gay because that was her experience. Somebody else would have a different experience and a different response to that song. And that's good.
Yeah.
You know, variety is the spice of life. You know, to actually say they must get this theme, they must get the theme the way I want them to. That actually kills off your creative work's kind of power.
Yeah, my sister many years ago did theatre studies at university, and we went to watch a play that she'd been in. And afterwards, I remember my dad saying to her, "Did the audience laugh in the right places?" And she said, "Well, wherever they laughed, that was the right place."
Exactly.
It was obviously funny. And that blew my kind of 13-year-old mind.
She was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be too precious as the creator of a creative work. You know, people will have the response that they have to whatever it is. That said, if they tell you what your response is supposed to be or what you intended, then that's wrong. You know, at the same time, you can't push it too far the other way either. At the end of the day, it's a very finely tuned balance.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't believe that, you know, I mean, in this age of the internet, often you'll find people really slagging authors and say, and screenwriters and saying, well, he or she is clearly a misogynist because of blah or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, stop right there. You know, what you are not, what you're not factoring in there is the fact that you're seeing fiction. You know, that is not reality.
Yeah.
You know, and just because somebody creates a creative work that maybe you don't agree with the theme, that doesn't give you the right to actually tell the author of that they're a bad person or that that's what they meant. You know, I was reading on Facebook this morning, somebody was having a really big rant about how people with mental health issues are always misrepresented on the screen, and the filmmakers say that they're trying to raise awareness and how this is all bullshit and they're really just ignorant and blah blah blah. And it's like, well, this is your response. Maybe that's not actually what they meant. You know, at the same time, you know, obviously some people are blatantly trolling, they're trying to be controversial, and they're being a pain in the ass. But most people have got good intentions. Most people want to actually create something of worth and of value that makes people happy. They don't want to actually be horrible to people. They don't want to be ignorant.
The trolling thing is a really interesting kind of relatively new phenomenon that writers are dealing with. I know, like, I blog partly as my job and partly voluntarily for, you know, a feminist website, disability website, that kind of thing. And it's got to the point now where, you know, when you write any opinionated blog post, that there'll be people who agree and there'll be people who disagree, and that's fine.
Absolutely.
But you know that there'll be another subset of people who will look specifically to find something to misrepresent.
Oh, God,
and will then fight you on that. And you can't defend yourself there because they're arguing something that you didn't even say.
Yeah.
But the F word, the feminist website I write for, is quite big, you know, a lot of readers, and so we get quite a lot of this. And it's at a point now where I'll write a post and I'll reread it as I normally do and rework it, but then I have to rework it again to try and find the bits that could be deliberately misrepresented, you know. And this is a real thing that we're dealing with on an increasing basis, I think, all kinds of writers, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I actually write one kind of long blog post a week now on Bang to Write. And I'll usually put it up on a Sunday. But it's usually written for a whole week before it goes up online, yes. Because I will write it and then I will add to it and then I will look through it and then I will check it and then I'll get somebody else to read it, because as you say, I'm looking for ways that that people will kind of try and stick the boots in, because that's what they're trying to do, because that's actually what they want to do. It's not actually anything to do with me. It's nothing to do with the writing craft. It's nothing to do with any of that. It's to do with the fact that they just want a kickback, because they do.
And that's not the same as just disagreeing. I think you and I would both be completely fine with somebody saying, you know, I've read this, I disagree because of A, B and C. That's fine.
Yeah, no, people disagree with me all the time, and that's absolutely fine, because, I mean, I've got very strong opinions, and I've got very kind of some, I kind of pride myself on being the voice of dissent.
Yes.
Yeah, you may have noticed this. So, you know, I always try not to be one step ahead, because that sounds too wanky. But, you know, I try and actually look ahead to what is the next kind of big discussion that we need to have. Because I think, you know, just going the whole time, you know, back in 2008, 2009, I was talking about female protagonists and there weren't many around. Yes. So I start talking about it. And then, you know, last year we ended up with loads of female protagonists, which is great. You know, things are actually moving on. So now I'm talking about masculinity and representations of masculinity, because, you know, they need an overhaul as well. And people are often telling me, oh, you know, it's male privilege, we don't need to talk about that. It's like, yeah, we do, because, you know, you can't just have one without the other. You know, we've got women, got men. You know, why would you say that the characterization of men is fine when it's clearly not? We've got lots of stereotypes here. We've got lots of bullshit here. You know, there's loads of boys walking around with the same kind of problems that young girls have about their feelings of their self-esteem to do with their bodies, because they're not really buff and ripped like Thor, you know?
Yeah, and it's not like the kind of imposed masculinities are great for women either.
No, exactly.
Even if you look at it from still a woman's point of view, you can still go, let's look at masculinity because it's a mess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of websites for men have started talking about the notion of toxic masculinity.
I think
that's a really, really interesting phrase, because it is. You know, there's lots of mixed messages about what it means to be a man, and what it means to be a hero, and what it means to be a father, or equally missing messages about what it means to be a father, especially in the black community. You know, this notion that automatically a black father just disappears from his kid's life. I mean, how fucking...
Yeah.
Hideous is that?
Yeah.
That's so insidious.
Yeah.
You know, we should be addressing these things, and yet it's strangely silent. And I'm not going to apologise for wanting to talk about those things.
Quite. Now, you mentioned your website. Now, this is bangtowrite.com, and that's a number two.
Mm-hmm.
What made you start it in the first place? Was it a business decision or just something you wanted to write?
Well, I mean, as I said, I've got loads of opinions, so I love the internet. I love to just talk all day. I mean, in the last sort of like 3 or 4 years, I've sent nearly 100,000 tweets for starters, you know?
Yeah.
I just love going on and on. So, you know, when I found out about blogs, was like 2005, I thought, fantastic, I can write about stuff on there.
I do want to.
Yeah, definitely. It was an AOL hometown blog. Do you remember those?
My first website was a GeoCities.
Yeah, you could only write in Comic Sans. Oh, my God.
I used to be really excited when I could make the text change colour.
I used to write blue Comic Sans with pink links. Oh, my God. I look back now.
I was trying to teach myself HTML years and years ago, and I found this website at the time that I just thought was the best thing in the world. And it was a website where you could just copy bits of code into your site, and it would make it do things like snow on the screen. Fireworks when you clicked your mouse or something. And I thought this was the best thing ever. And so my GeoCities site, like every page of it, all of which was hand-coded very badly, had some kind of exploding text or wobbling lines.
Mine did as well.
Yeah.
Oh, Oh, God, yeah. But, yeah, I loved my blog at first, and I was just writing randomly at first. I was just writing all kinds of crap on there. Then I started getting fan mail from a lady called Mary, and she lived in Alabama. And that's when I realised that I wasn't just talking to myself.
Yeah.
The people were actually reading this stuff.
Yeah.
And she wanted to ask about, I would write about my son and stuff like that. And I was just using it as a diary at first. And I wrote a couple of stories and I stuck them on there. And she liked these stories. And I suddenly realized, oh, these things are quite powerful. And I'd started the script reading on a kind of more, what's the word?
Formal.
Yes, I'd started in a more formal way, and I was advertising on various bulletin boards and stuff, and getting sort of 2 or 3 clients a week by this point. And I noticed that I was writing the same sort of things to them all the time.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of screenplays have essentially got the same problems, you know, problems of things like structure and character, the two big things.
Mm.
So rather than write the same thing to all 3 clients, I'd write an article on the blog and then direct them to that.
Oh, yes.
So that they could see, you know, the main kind of problem. And then I could write the specific notes to their screenplay with that in mind.
Yeah.
And that worked really well. And people really kind of got on board with that, and they liked kind of the extra value from that. And so for a long time, I was just writing articles on that blog, thinking, oh, only my clients would be reading it.
Yeah.
And then about a year after I'd started this blog, I started getting, like, lots of comments and emails from people saying, oh, can you write an article about this screenwriting problem or that screenwriting problem.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay. So I started taking questions. This was before Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And it became very kind of interactive. And I discovered other screenwriters were writing their own blogs. Most of their blogs were like online diaries of whether they were going to make it or not.
Yeah.
Or they just started, you know, writing a project for a producer and, you know, they were doing diaries of that and things like that. And so, and somebody came along and they made like this, I suppose it's like a library aggregator thing of all the blogs about writing.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And it became what was known back then as the scribosphere.
That's excellent.
And we all call ourselves the scribes of the scribosphere, and I think there was about 50 of us, and some of them were quite big, you know, like John August, and who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Go and Ken Levine, who wrote MASH and things. And then there were people like, you know, Tiny Look, people like me, and then there was like the middly kind of TV writers from this country as well.
Yeah.
It just got bigger and bigger, and then Twitter came along and Facebook came along, and people started to kind of integrate their blogs into their Facebook, and then weirdly all the commentary all went over to Facebook and Twitter, and now you don't see a lot of comments on blogs.
It's true, and it's interesting hearing kind of how your site developed, because in modern day internet marketing type speak, what you were doing was positioning yourself as an authority, which then makes people respect you and think, oh, she clearly knows what she's doing. And so they'll say to someone else, she knows what she's doing. And they think, oh, she knows what she's doing. And you, and then the more people think well of you, the more they think, oh, we'll hire her.
Yeah.
And this is what a lot of modern internet marketers try to create, kind of a bit too, in a bit too much of a planned way.
Mm.
Whereas when it happens organically like yours did, this wasn't you setting out saying, I'm going to write useful things and so people will think I'm useful. You were just, you know, writing what occurred to you, and then a few patterns started emerging. But the result was that you were writing things that were useful to enough people that you began to be recognised as someone who actually did know what they were talking about.
Yeah, which is pretty random because I probably didn't. it just seemed common sense to me, and I think that's probably the key behind good social media marketing is it's common sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't whine on social media about how hard everything is every 5 minutes, and you don't slag everybody off, and you don't. And you try and help other people, and you try and be pleasant, and you have a laugh and whatever, and people will like you and pass your content on. You know, it's just, it seems obvious to me, but very often it can't be that obvious because I see loads of people,
screwing it up.
Oh God, so wrong. Yeah. So wrong. I mean, I write social media posts on Bang to Write now because so many people ask me about it now. It's like, well, you know, what do I do? How do I set myself up on Twitter? How do I create a blog? How do I do a good digital footprint? And all that bloody jargon.
People want to automate the process so much, mm-hmm. and kind of lose sight of the common sense side of things, I think.
Yeah, it's about human interaction and common sense. That's all it is.
We met on Twitter initially.
Yes.
We chat embarrassingly a lot on Facebook. Not that either of us are there all the time. But, you know, we both use both mediums a lot, and it's interesting to see how writers are using them. And I saw, it was a few weeks ago, and obviously I won't name who, but it was a copywriter who normally tweets just fairly sensible copywriting things, and then ended up live tweeting. Oh, I'm embarrassed for her just thinking about it. The kind of 5 hours following her husband telling her that he was leaving her.
Oh, blimey.
And she fell apart, not unreasonably.
No, of course. Yeah.
But spent 5 hours of tweet after tweet after tweet of kind of rage, then despair, then rage, then despair. And it was kind of painful to watch.
It can be.
Yeah. And if it's a personal account, then do what you will, frankly. But you do have to be a bit more careful with professional accounts.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I tweet personal things sometimes, you know, especially if I'm upset. I have been known to kind of rage a little bit, but I try and allow myself only 3 tweets.
That's it.
And then I have to kind of, you know, walk around the block a few times. Occasionally I might get drawn into a dog pile or whatever. Yeah. There was one only last week where a certain keyboard warrior came after me because apparently I'm racist and classist and all the usual ists, you know, based on a single tweet I made in November, you know. So rather than ask me about the context of the tweet, which, by the way, was storified, you know, they start, you know, slacking off, like, whatever, you know, they were looking for a ruck, basically.
Yes, I know.
So to protect my brand, I kind of just, you know, kept throwing it back, you know, and they kept coming back with the same nonsense over and over again. It's like, oh, my God. And then I wrote a nice long post about the issue on Bang to Write without naming her.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to kind of, you know, if anybody ever kind of takes it wrong again, they can see, you know, the actual, what's the word, the trail of tweets.
Yes.
And the trail of content to show that actually that's just bullshit, you know? So, I think it's useful that if somebody does launch, an unprovoked attack like that, then you should protect your brand, I think. I could have got like really personal and all that kind of stuff, but I don't see the point of that because, you know, she was the one that ended up looking like an idiot.
And you do have to, you know, you are a person that, you know, it is the brand, but you're a person behind it and you can't be entirely robotic, and nor would you be an interesting person to follow if you were, frankly.
You know,
it's a difficult balance, the kind of personality,
how much
should come into it. But it's an interesting one that kind of evolves, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really key, is this notion of evolution. I didn't tell people that I was ill on social media. I didn't tell anyone that I had cancer on social media when it was all going on. I didn't want to be the one with cancer. You know, it wasn't what I wanted to do. But, you know, the people that I actually knew in real life all knew about it. And the people that I worked with on a regular basis all knew about it.
Yeah.
And again, you know, people were really nice to me on social media. They knew that I didn't want to talk about it in public. But, you know, they were always there all the time. You know, they'd know that I would be in the hospital sort of like every 3 weeks or whatever for chemo, and they'd be on my phone with me the whole time, which was great. And that was really helpful as well, especially because when you're on chemo as well, you can't sleep a lot of the time. So I'd literally be awake for sort of like, you know, 21, 22 hours out of 24, and I'd be on Twitter most of it. You know, it was really great, you know, that people were always there, which was nice. And it does stop you from feeling lonely, which is great. And that's a brilliant aspect of social media, because you can feel like you've got moral support, but equally it can work the other way and you can feel kind of harangued as well.
Yeah, there's been an interesting story that's blown up in the last day or two about an article that someone wrote in The Guardian. Now, I first came across this because someone pointed out the quite exceptional statement that this article has now been replaced with.
Right.
What was the full article now says, this post has been deleted with the agreement of the subject because it is inconsistent with the Guardian editorial code.
Right.
Which nothing would make me search the internet more, frankly, to find out what on earth was going on here, because I've never seen a statement like that. Mm-hmm. And I could still see the title to the piece, which was Forget Funeral Selfies, What Are the Ethics of Tweeting a Terminal Illness?
Right.
And I could still see all the comments to the piece, which thought it was horrific.
Right.
And so I, of course, had to find out what it was. And Google Cache wasn't giving me anything and all the obvious things, so I had to search further and further and further. Anyway, I eventually found it because when I get determined, I get determined.
Right.
And basically, there's a woman who has terminal cancer and has been tweeting a lot. Now, I know and tweet with a lot of disabled people. And so somebody tweeting about their body or their pain or their treatment doesn't really stand out to me. This woman's tweet, she's not somebody I know on Twitter. She's called Lisa Adams. And she's tweeting very honestly about this kind of last stage that she's in and the pain she's in and just how hard it is, which I will say now I think is fully within her rights. It's her Twitter account. She can tweet what she likes. But what a Guardian journalist did was write an article, a really horrific article, criticising this woman for tweeting about this, saying it's basically too much information. I don't know why I can't stop reading it, but I can't stop reading it. But there's some people just share too much, and do we have no limits anymore? And this Guardian journalist compares the tweets at one point to a grim equivalent of deathbed selfies.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Why are you saying this? If you don't want to see this, don't follow her. She's very open that this is what she's tweeting about. And I saw lots of articles criticising the original article and then finally found a kind of cache of a cache of a cache and found the article itself. And it is bad. It's and I'm not surprised The Guardian have taken it down. But it's all, for me, that's very much, she's got exactly the same choice that you had, and you chose that for you, tweeting about this very openly wasn't what you wanted to be doing, and that's entirely within your rights. And this woman had exactly the same choice, and for her, tweeting openly was what she wanted to do about it, and that is also entirely within her rights.
Absolutely, Anyway, screenwriting.
Yes, right. Yeah, Twitter, I've noticed, I don't know whether you started this or whether you participate in it, but the hashtag script chat.
Yes.
Tell me about that, because I like hashtags.
Yes. Oh, hashtags are brilliant. I love hashtags. I didn't start Script Chats. As far as I know, it came into being around 2009, something like that.
Okay.
It's been around for ages. Yeah, it was one of the kind of first things on Twitter over there in the first place. And three people in America started Script Chat, and then they do a Euro Script Chat as well, and they got three people in the UK to do that. I don't know if they do it in any other country as well, but there's two main ones: Euro Script Chat on a Sunday, which is at 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, and then they've got US Script Chat, which is about 10 o'clock our time.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they moderate a chat every week for an hour, 8 till 9 on a Sunday Euro, and then 10 to 11 US. The three moderators for the US chat will usually have some sort of guest coming in to talk about various things. They nearly always have a guest. The UK moderators don't have a guest quite as often, I've noticed, but they have a blog, and they kind of facilitate questions and stuff through there, and suggestions for topics. So organically, other people who are talking about writing on Twitter will use hashtags throughout the week as well, and I take full advantage of that and kind of put all my musings about screenwriting or script reading, I'll hashtag with Script Chat.
Yeah.
And also all my blog posts and things like that as well. And Script Chat's really good. It's a really good way of finding mostly screenwriters, but in the last year or so, novelists have started using it as well, especially the people who publish to the Kindle as well. So that's really good to see more novel writers on there as well. It does get taken over a bit by promo.
A lot of the hashtags do now, and it's a real shame.
Yeah,
but if you can see through that,
mm-hmm.
they can be really... I used to participate in a monthly writer's chat with a hashtag that I still never quite get in the right order. I think it's WCLW,
mm-hmm.
which is Writer's Chat Last Wednesday, and it's just the last Wednesday mm-hmm. of the month, and it's mm-hmm. for an hour. And I've kind of got out of the habit because it's US time, and it doesn't always translate to the same time here. But that's was started by a freelance writer called Michelle Rafter, who's got a website. Mm-hmm. And she will set a theme and certain questions, and sometimes there'll be a guest answering questions. Mm-hmm. Other times it's just a general discussion. But I see so many hashtags now. There's like Sheffield Hour and Yorkshire Hour, and there's UK Freelance, and there's just so many. Every issue, every...
Mm-hmm.
job, and I think they're a really good thing. Although now there are more of them, I pay a bit less attention sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think when there were fewer of them, I probably focused a bit more on them, whereas they just pass me by a bit now. But they can be just a really good way of organising Twitter into a topic.
Definitely. And I probably use Script Chat the most, followed by Am Writing.
Yes, I use that one.
Also novels as well is an obvious one. I use the Femme2 one a lot to kind of get, representation of women out a bit more.
Yeah.
Also about pregnancy, because obviously that's a personal interest of mine, but also something that I write about. I'll use Femme2, Teen Preg, Teens quite a lot.
Yeah.
I try and kind of do some outreach work via Twitter and Ask FM with teenagers to answer their questions, especially about teenage pregnancy, but also about other issues as well. I talk quite a lot on Facebook to a few teens about cyberbullying, and it's, some of the shit they put each other through. It's just horrible. It's really bad, all the memes that they do and setting up pages to mock them and things like that. It's just really nasty shit. I'm so glad it wasn't around when I was.
I often think that when I'll see a documentary or something about cyberbullying and I just think, I had some rough times at school, but I was so glad that I'm so glad now that when I got home, I wasn't then having that.
Yeah, right. You know, because kids, sort of like 10 years ago, had mobile phones to worry about, you know, text message hassle.
Yeah.
You know, being...
I'm too old to have even had that.
Yeah, me too. So, you know, at least when you got
we
home...
We got bullied through the post. Royal Mail bullying.
Yeah, right. But yeah, no, it's yeah, we could get home, close the door on it, you know, they can't even do that now. It's just horrible. It's really horrible. So, you know, and also it's another way of actually taking the mick even more, you know, out of people who've got, problems, or disability or an issue like teen pregnancy or whatever. That said, at least, there is the feeling as well that you can actually bandy together with people who are being hassled as well. You know, you can actually, you know, it's a kind of a double-edged sword. You know, on one hand, you can be harangued, but on the other hand, you can actually find out you're not the only one.
Yeah, you can communicate with all sorts of people.
You know, I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, I literally thought I was the only one that thought the way I did. I really, really believed that 100% until I was quite old, actually. I was about 22, 23 before I realised that actually other people felt the same way about certain things as I did.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, growing up gay, I would never have called it that when I was a kid because it terrified me. Mm. I had no frame of reference other than it being a bad thing.
Mm.
And in so many ways, the internet would have made for me that progression to actually this is fine and it's me would have made it a million times easier.
Yep.
Because there was nothing then. There was the odd article in a teenage magazine, but very rare. And so, in that way, the internet would have made things far more accessible to me.
Yep. Definitely, and it would have been the same for me as a teen mother, especially living in a rural area.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't know anyone with a baby that was my age. Nobody at all.
Yeah.
And I was horribly lonely because I didn't get to see anyone or do anything in a place that was so remote. I couldn't even go into town or anything. I was literally just in the middle of, like, a field, basically.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, if I just had Twitter on my phone even, just Twitter, I would, you know, life would have been a bit more bearable. Yeah. But as a result, I was having to read sort of like 6 books in a fortnight to have any kind of relief, you know.
And the good thing, well, one of the very good things about hashtags is that it's a kind of easy way of zoning in on the right people.
Absolutely.
Whether that's a personal issue like hashtag Team Preg, or whether it's a professional thing, like I want to talk to other UK freelancers, then even if you've just joined the site, you've got instant access to that community. Yep. And also, anyone else who checks those hashtags will see you pop up. And so relationships start to be built, which is, you know, the beginning of all good things, really.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. I think Twitter is absolutely fantastic. I adore it. And I, you know, a couple of times a year I kind of get sick of it and go, I'm never going on Twitter again.
Yes.
But I'm literally back on it within about 5 hours.
So Lucy, thank you so much for coming and talking on the podcast. It's been really interesting to find out more about screenwriting and script editing, and good to talk social media with someone else who I know is really into social media. If people want to say hi to you, Lucy, or have a read of your blog, perhaps look at your social media feeds, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, all you have to do is you can find me via Google, because I'm the only bang to write online, which is BANG2WRITE. Mm. And you can find my website, which is bangtowrite.com, or I'm bang to write on Twitter. On Facebook, there's a writers group called Bang to Writers, and there's another one on LinkedIn. You can also find me on various other platforms like Quora and Pinterest. And I think I'm even on Foursquare as well, though I don't really understand what that is. But occasionally people add me on there. So find me on there if you want.
And I will also put links to all those places in the show notes at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com. So if you listen to this and then by the time you get home you've forgotten, just come to the podcast website and there will be links directly to all of Lucy's online stuff.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And so before we finish up, there is now just time for a quick recommendation of the week. And my recommendation this week is a blog post by Carol Tice on makealivingwriting.com. And it's called Can You Spot These Three Different Freelance Writing Scams? And we always all have to be on the lookout for people trying to exploit our, frankly, good nature and get work out of us for nothing, or indeed charge us for work, which is more common than you might expect. And so what Carol does in this post is go through three examples from her own experience, but really they apply to so many of us. We, you know, any writer with any kind of platform gets approached with this stuff all the time, and you have to know what to look for and what the warning signs are. And so I will, of course, link to that in the show notes. But that's just a quick recommendation for this week. Now, we will be back for a dual episode in 2 weeks' time. So come back then to hear me and Laurie talking shop. I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Lucy. Head over to alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com. And as well as all the links to subscribe to the podcast and to my websites and social media feeds, you will also find links to all the films we've talked about, all of Lucy's own websites and social media stuff, and plenty more. So thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next time.